The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk with Mastercard.
Now, my next guest was once the highest ranking Catholic in the Northern Irish Police Force, and over the course of the Troubles, he survived numerous attempts on his life by the Provisional IRA. His life was dedicated to service that came at great personal risk, and 20 years on from the IRA ceasefire in the summer of 97, he's with us now to look back on his career and look ahead to the future for peace on this island at a very uncertain time. Peter Sheridan, who's now Chief Executive of Cooperation Ireland, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Pat.
Why did a young fellow want to join, as a Catholic, the RUC?
Well, I'm not sure I wanted to join. My careers teacher at the time was a Catholic priest who was an Irish historian. He probably didn't support all things British, but for some bizarre reason, he had suggested to me that I should consider a career in policing. He didn't specifically say the RUC, although he brought the RUC recruiting sergeant up to meet me. And bizarrely, I didn't know it, but when I did join there, sitting in the same class was another fellow from my class in school, and neither the two of us knew, and yet we were close friends.
Okay, so two Catholics join at the same time. Yeah. Did you contemplate a less sectarian force, like the Garda Síochána across the border? I don't know how you regarded that, or even one of the British police forces like the Met in London, or one of the regional forces?
Well, I'm not sure I classified as a sectarian, but I at the time at home, there would obviously have been some discussion, because when I was applying to join, it was 1975, and there were about 500 people murdered in Northern Ireland that year. So for my parents, it would have been, you know, they've been very conscious of the security end of it. I was 16 years of age, so I was following George Best at the time and the girls from the collegiate school up the road. So my knowledge of politics probably wasn't, or awareness of politics wasn't great at the time. But so when the discussion happened, you know, it was, would you not be better going to join the Met or the Scottish Police or the Guards? So I literally did apply to join the Metropolitan Police and Garda Síochána. I got a reply from the Met Police saying that they weren't recruiting that year. Yeah. And I'm still waiting on a reply from the Guards.
Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. So the RUC, it became. The personal risks that were involved, I mean, for any member of the police force at the time, the IRA would have seen them as legitimate targets. But to add to that, the fact that you were a Catholic might have signalled you out for special attention.
Yes, well, I lived in Derry for the 25 years I was stationed there. So it, because I rose up through the ranks, I would have become well known in the city. And so therefore, you know, yes, being Catholic, but being well known in the city also would have meant that I would have been a bigger target for people, or at least a better known target.
You've spoken about your relationship with Martin McGuinness, which in later years was, I don't know whether you'd characterise it as a friendship, but certainly it was a deep acquaintance.
No, I would characterise it as a friendship. Not necessarily a friendship that, you know, we would have been dining in each other's houses or going on holidays with our wives together. Not that sort of friendship, but a friendship in that we kind of understood one another. If I ever rang him, he'd always call me back again, and likewise. Yeah. So we got on at the end of it.
But you used to joke that you spent more time in Martin McGuinness's house than he did. Yeah. Explain.
Well, I kind of used it as an icebreaker. We shared platforms together during the peace process, and as kind of an introduction, I said I spent longer in his house in the last 30 years than he did. And some of it was sort of an indication that, you know, we were looking for Martin McGuinness.
He was on the run.
He wasn't necessarily on the run, but he was never at home too often. But we were looking for him, and he would have been subject to arrest and so on. And so as a police service, we would have been in his house pretty often.
People can forget so easily the Troubles, not those who suffer directly from them, but the population down here particularly, who didn't really have close contact with the Troubles. Most people in the North had some sort of contact with the Troubles, but it's easy to forget. Now, if we go back to the death of a man called Leslie Jarvis, and really your first encounter, although you didn't know it, with the IRA side of Martin McGuinness's life.
Yeah. So Leslie Jarvis was worked as a leather worker in the prison. So because he did that, he was seen as a legitimate target.
He also just because he did a craft in the prison.
In the prison, yes. And so he also lectured part-time at McGee University in Derry. And when he was lecturing one evening, as he got out to get into his car, he was shot dead in his car. I happened to be close by and went to the scene immediately. And I went over to his car, was sitting at the front of the university, and I could see pretty quickly that he was deceased. And I remember looking around his car and seeing in the back of his car his briefcase. I did what, you know, police officers do then, started cordoning off the area, called for the detectives, and they arrived some 20 minutes later. And two of the detectives, John Bennison and Austin Wilson, were standing over his car. One of them asked me for a loan of my torch. They were looking at the tax disc in the car, and I went over, gave them my torch, and I'd literally walked away 15 feet when the car exploded, killing the two of them instantly and blowing me off my feet along with a number of other police officers. What the IRA had done, they had replaced Leslie Jarvis's briefcase in the back of his car with a bomb. And obviously it was a setup, so he was almost cannon fodder. Shoot Leslie Jarvis to get the police to come to the scene and then...
And take out two policemen.
Or whatever number they could at the time.
And the connection that Martin McGuinness had, which was revealed later on.
Yeah, well, I wasn't aware of any of this, and the police didn't say this at the time, but Liam Clark, the journalist who's now deceased, and his wife wrote a book, and in that book they interviewed an IRA man who said, and obviously I can't stand over this, who said that Martin McGuinness was standing close by and observed it happening.
Job well done, kind of thing.
Well, that was the indication from the IRA member who said that.
This was, if you like, an accidental attempt on your life. It could have been any member of the force that was the target there. But you yourself were personally targeted as well, and information came to light. They would have killed you coming out of church.
Yeah. Well, thanks to the guards, who I'm still waiting on that reply from, they stopped somebody in County Donegal, and in searching him, they discovered that he had my details of when I attended Mass on a Sunday, including the names of my kids and my wife and what time we would have been there, etc. And so they intercepted, and the intelligence was at the time that there was going to be an attempt made in my life at coming out of Mass on a Sunday. And some people remember it wouldn't have been the first time, because a police officer murdered coming out of the Gran in Enniskillen. As he left Mass to get into his carriage.
And this would have been to try and act as a deterrent to any Catholic who might ever have thought of joining the police force.
Yeah, particularly in a place like Derry, and it would have been sending a message loud and clear.
Derry is a city, but it's a small city.
It is.
So everybody knows everybody, and everybody knows where everybody lives. How do you protect your family in a situation like this?
You do the normal things. I lived in my house and had to move out of it twice because of intelligence that they were going to attack me at my home. And then the state fortified my house. So I lived in a house that had armoured glass in the windows and electric gates and so on. But I didn't let it rule my life. You know, I didn't do stupid things. I wouldn't have went to the Bogside Inn as my local pub. But nevertheless, I didn't let it interfere with my life. Of course, travelling to work every day, you didn't go at the same time or leave the same route. So you'd have been conscious of those things, but it just became part of everyday life.
Now, did it change with the PSNI? You had come up through the ranks of the RUC, it became the PSNI. Did the atmosphere change in terms of you being a so-called legitimate target? After the ceasefire, of course, the IRA were not going to target you, but some of the splinter groups.
Yeah, it changed to a certain extent. But then when dissident groups became more prevalent and the shooting of police officers again by dissidents, it does interfere with that trying to be a normal police service. It requires police officers to be more conscious about, you know, their own security. And that's not necessarily what you want to be as a police officer. You want to live and work and be part of the community like a teacher, a nurse, a doctor, whatever else.
In the course of the peace process, when next did you come up against Martin McGuinness, the politician rather than the IRA man?
So I had an interesting, and sometimes you don't set out in life to have these relationships, but they happen as a matter of course in life. And I had been at a Garda meeting in Dublin in 2004, and I took a walk up Grafton Street at lunchtime, and I bought a book called Nell in one of the local bookshops by Nell McCafferty. And I knew Nell from Derry, and I rang her and said I'd refused to read her book unless she signed it. So she challenged me to come over to the Bogside at the weekend to get it signed, and I thought I'd be there for 2 minutes and back out the door again, because it wasn't somewhere as a police officer I should have been. But she insisted I come in and meet her mother, who'd had several strokes, and they lived in a small terrace house, and I had a lovely conversation with her mother, who I discovered her grandfather was known as the Good Sergeant Duffy, an RIC officer. But in the house, Nell had insisted that I have a bowl of soup. And when I was having the soup, she announced to me that it was made by Peggy McGuinness. And I, of course, joked with her that she was trying to poison me.
It's Martin's mother.
Martin McGuinness's mother, yes. And so, bizarrely, the next day, it was a Sunday, and Hugh Orde, who was then chief constable, had called me and said that the Prime Minister had called a meeting in Downing Street. The next morning, it was the first time Sinn Féin were going to meet the police. And so he and I went to that meeting. And there was no shaking of hands at the beginning of it. The meeting lasted about 2 hours. It was about policing and Sinn Féin support for policing and so on. But on the way out the door, I happened to be last at the door, and Martin McGuinness was on his way out last. And it's one of those moments that you wonder, what do? In shaking hands, you know, him and I were probably the only people in the room, or me and Sinn Féin were the only people in the room that had any baggage, because Hugh Orde had never been in the RUC. And because I was a police commander in Derry and Martin was a commander of a different style. So it's one of those moments that you think to yourself, what do I do here? So I reached out my hand to shake hands with him, and I said to him, your mother makes great soup. And he looked at me bizarrely. Now, as somebody who was head of intelligence at the time, you think I would have known that some of the family grow organic vegetables in County Donegal, and the mother was well known for the soup she made out of them. So it kind of broke the ice in it, and he said to me, how did I know? And I said, I had a bowl of it on Saturday. And he asked me, where did I get a bowl of it on Saturday? And I said to him, well, to make sure you come back to the next meeting, I'll tell you then.
Of course, he was able to do his own research.
He was on his way home when he rang his mother, and his mother had told him there was a cop at Nell's house on Saturday. And so it kind of came from there.
Yeah. And the remark you made that you would not have been welcome in the Bogside. We're talking about 2004.
Yeah.
The peace process has been underway. The ceasefire has been in operation since 97. And still, it was kind of a no-go area for anyone with your, as you put it, baggage.
Yeah, well, I mean, Sinn Féin hadn't signed up to policing at that stage. So it wasn't support by Sinn Féin for policing. And even after the support, I think in many ways they held policing in probation for far too long. I remember at that meeting in Downing Street saying to them, you know, while we were talking about high level, you know, support for policing, I also said to them that if people who owned the picket fence in the Shintello estate in Derry didn't see change pretty quickly, then this would go on longer than anyone's wanted. And unfortunately, I think that was the case. You know, there was an initial raft of support for policing, and then it kind of held back for the next number of years, and it wasn't fully embraced.
Now, the evolution of Martin McGuinness into politician and statesman, and, you know, who knows at what point he formally left the IRA, although, I mean, two sides of the same coin, each side knowing what the other was doing anyway. How did you look upon that evolution of Martin into statesman?
Well, I've said, you know, that I didn't know Martin McGuinness in the first 20 years of his life when he grew up in the Bogside, undoubtedly in poverty, undoubtedly with discrimination. So I didn't know him at that stage because I was younger than Martin McGuinness. I knew of him in the next 20 years of his life when I was in the police in Derry, and obviously we were consistently briefed about Martin McGuinness. So I knew of him. But I got to know Martin McGuinness in the last 20 years of his life when he was in the peace process. And I think it was Ian Paisley Jr. who said that it's important. What's not important is how people start their life, it's how they end their life. And I think that Martin McGuinness played a huge contribution to bring about peace on this island.
Obviously, you don't harbour any kind of recriminations against him or his memory for what was tried to be done to you.
Well, I always took the view it probably wasn't directly personal to me because he didn't know me. It was more to do with
And also, there are many links in that chain that led to...
Absolutely. You know, it was the person who was, instead of saying their prayers on a Sunday at Mass, they were taking details of when I was there and passing them on. You know, bizarrely, you know...
Sitting in a pew, looking at you and making...
gathering intelligence rather than paying attention to what was happening up the front. But I also, you know, had a discussion, you know... This wasn't an easy or comfortable relationship with Martin McGuinness. I did say that, you know, when I went to bed at night, I never went to bed wondering who I could shoot, kill, bomb or maim. Nor did I get up any morning in life thinking of anybody as my enemy. And that included Martin McGuinness or people in the organisation with him. I didn't think like that in it. But I suppose I took some solace from the fact that it was probably the uniform more than me, the person, that the target was.
Yeah. And where we are today with the prospect of a hard border with Brexit, and I mean Downing Street seems to be reinforcing that notion in spite of the Chancellor of the Exchequer trying to soften the whole message that's coming across. I mean, the dangers for someone like you who's been a policeman all of your, well, you're in another life now, but most of your professional life, the dangers are quite stark.
Well, as Cooperation Ireland, we took a view at the time of the referendum that was we would remain neutral, simply because I have people like Peter Robison, the former First Minister, on my board, who has obviously wanted to exit Europe. I have John Bruton, the former Taoiseach, who's my Vice Chairman, who would have been a big supporter of Europe. So we took a neutral view on it. But for me, I think too often people saw the conflict as one about Catholic-Protestant. It wasn't. It was about identity. Some people saw their allegiances to the Republic of Ireland. Some people saw their allegiances to Westminster. So once you established a border that created a border between people and where their allegiance was, that became the point of conflict. And you know, when I met with Michel Barnier some weeks back, I made the point to him that...
You brought him to the border area.
Well, he was down in the border, and I was asked to meet him, and I spent some time in the car with him. And he had just spoken in the Doyle the day before about border management and customs controls. And I pointed out to him, if you only think as far as customs, we make the possibility of a further mistake again, because customs posts in the past were points of conflict. So when the first shots were fired at customs posts, it required the police to protect customs officers. When police officers were then attacked at customs posts, it required the army to protect police officers. And in that small area of South Armagh that I took him round, I said that within 10 miles we had 10 watchtowers, 4 helicopter bases, 4 police stations, 4 army bases, 6 roads that were permanent roads that had permanent checkpoints on them, and the only roads that you could get between north and south, and a series of up to about 40-odd roads sealed off in it. And so the danger of just thinking of customs, and we need customs managers. Yeah. So I am impressed on them the need to think just beyond the customs and to think about this, about an issue of identity for people. And it doesn't matter where that border is, because I've heard this week people saying that the border would be down the middle of the Irish Sea. You know, if the border's down the middle of the Irish Sea, then you run the possibility of a semi-detached status for Northern Protestants who cede their allegiance to the Westminster.
I mean, are they going to like passport control, leaving Belfast to go to London?
No. So what we have to be careful is not to create a semi-detached status for Northern nationalists who cede their allegiance to the rest of Ireland, or a semi-detached status for Northern Protestants who see their allegiances to Westminster. So the border is a key issue in this, and I do think people recognise that, and they need to then...
This is the imaginative creative solutions. What are they, though?
Well, that's the EU Council talked about an imaginative creative solution, so they will need to find those in the interests of this place. And, you know, the Prime Minister in their Article 50 letter talked about the need to protect the peace process, specifically in the letter. Michel Barnier that day in the Doyle talked about the need to protect the peace process and protect peace. So that's what they now have to deliver on. Yeah. And that means a recognition that there are dual nationalities on this island.
In terms of the dual nationalities and how they live together, I mean, Derry, predominantly Catholic, Belfast, obviously mixed, but the demographics changing all the time. How would you characterise the difference between the two cities? Because I know that there are far more peace walls in Belfast today than there were at the time of the peace process being signed off on.
Yeah, well, I mean, Derry is obviously a border county, so, you know, you can spend euros in Derry as well as spend sterling across the way in Donegal. That's not the same issue in Belfast. And yes, you're correct. You know, before the Good Friday Agreement, I think we'd somewhere in the region of, people call them peace walls. I tend to call them walls of division, because peace walls are sound like something you'd want in your own backyard, and they sound that nice. There were 18 of those before the Good Friday Agreement. There are somewhere around 88 today. So we have built more divisions between communities. And if you add on top of that that 95% of social housing is segregated, our education system is segregated, the real danger of settling for some sort of communal division albeit that the vast majority of the violence has stopped. But what we want is an integrated society, not a segregated society.
And the notion that the nationalist population, the traditionally Catholic population, are in the ascendant, and that builds even a more entrenched siege mentality in the loyalist population. I mean, that is demonstrably true, I think.
Yeah, well, I've argued, you know, that what I would like to see, what Corporation Ireland and would like to see, is that I would love to see our politicians, particularly the two big political parties, writing two new manifestos. So asking Sinn Féin to write a manifesto that says what they're going to do to protect the cultural rights and traditions of the Protestant community, including the Orange Order. What they're going to do to protect that identity that people in the Protestant community see. And then what the DUP should do is write a similar manifesto that says what they're going to do to protect the Catholic rights and identity. That includes things like Irish language and so on. And then we will begin to see, you know, rather than champion their own side's cause, this is about reconciliation for Cooperation Ireland. And we're coming still out of conflict, but how do we get to learn to live together like citizens and not enemies? And so part of that has been willing to protect the rights of the other. Good human rights is when you protect the other person's
rights. Isn't it also the way you observe things? I mean, I see on television some of the loyalist parades and the young fellas with the big drums, and they're swaggering along sort of with splayed feet as they go. And it looks hilarious. Because I'm not involved. I'm not emotionally challenged by this. And I often thought that if the people walking down the Gavrahi Road could just smile and look at them and say, well, that's a square spectacle, but let them at it for a day. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It does depend on your attitude. But if you see it as two fingers to your community, obviously, if you're viscerally affected by that.
Well, I never missed an Orange Parade for 30 years. Not through choice, but
on duty.
On duty in it. But I did get to understand that it's people's culture. And unfortunately, sometimes on the other side, we don't recognise that it is culture for people. And that's why I say that I would desperately like to see politicians genuinely sitting down and saying, what is it I can do or we can do to protect your culture? Because once they do that, then they take that fear factor out from the other side, that their culture is going to be, you know, diluted or trodden on or effectively taken away from them. So we need to change the dynamics, I think, in this, that we get them to consider not just championing their own side's cause, but starting to champion the other side's cause.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, Michel Barnier, when he saw the lack of border, I mean, he looked at a landscape, there was nothing.
Well, I said to him, do you see the border there, Commissioner? And he said, no, where? And I said to him, that's the idea, you don't see it.
That's the idea. you know, the prospect of going back in time. I remember as a young fella going up north in my uncle's car, and passing burnt out customs posts. That was before the Troubles. There was a campaign that was doing that just to be disruptive. And then they put up prefabs and Nissan huts or whatever and do it all again until they were attacked. You know, because of what we've been through in the north, it won't be as benign as that.
Well, it's difficult at this stage to see that it'll be as benign. I mean, I lived in Enniskillen and Sunday we went to Bundoran and you started a queue of traffic on the northern side as you went through the customs. Almost inevitably to be waved on, but you were in a queue of traffic for 20 minutes. Yeah. Then you got to Ballyshannon where there was the customs post on the southern side of the border, back into the same queue again to be inevitably waved on, and then returning in the evening time. And I don't think any of us want to go back to that. And I do remember even as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, that sense of aggravation or frustration that you had of sitting in a car when you could have been sitting on Bundoran Beach with an ice cream.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we will never go back to that. Some of the comments coming in, great interview. I'm meant to be in work, but I haven't left the van. Well spoken to Peter. The Gardaí lost an amazing man through its incompetence in its recruitment. What an amazing man is Peter Sheridan. That's from Tom. So Peter, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us this morning. Thank you.